trying to remember. We have like a reading.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Okay.
Okay, so last time we finished up talking about the various components that HTLRS provides that you'll need to use to implement your processor. So we talked about how the data memory works. That's the memory you're going to use to access anything that isn't the contents of an instruction. And also how the register file worked, which is how you're going to change the values of REX, RBX, and so on. And your instructions need to do that, since we'd like to easily find out what you think those values are, and also you probably don't want to handle the given a register number, find that value logic yourself. We mentioned that our textbook has some fixed design decisions that maybe you don't like. Like your textbook adds 0 to implement I remove Q, it has the mport for memory results, makes these various arbitrary decisions that you could choose not to do because HTLRS has the flexibility to like add muxes wherever you want, which wasn't true in our textbook system. And we went through 2 different approaches for building CPUs. So one was that we could look at the stages that our textbook talks about and systematically just look at, here's the stage, let's look at all the instructions I care about, figure out what needs to happen that's in the box for this stage. So my stage is decode, what needs to happen as far as reading registers for each possible instruction, just list them all out, and then from that you can figure out what mux do I need, how does that mux get set for each of these instructions based on what needs to happen. Another example, way approached was that, well, our textbook has a solution for all the muxes that'll work, and you can just say, okay, here's my whole diagram, I know what the instruction does, I'm just going to trace backwards, like I know I have an MR move queue, so I know the input to the register file needs to be the value from memory, so I'm going to say, how can I do that, figure out what mux I need to set based on that, and then I'm going to work from that and say, I need to read memory at this address, how can I do that, and keep working backwards. And if ever I find out, oh, there's not any way to do that, you always have the option of saying, okay, I'm just going to add a mux or add an input to a mux to make that possible. So, and both are completely valid approaches for when we have to do assignments where we're going to say, give us a processor with these instructions. Go through either approach. So last time we started going through sort of our textbook's notions of the stages of RID6. We started with fetch. We mentioned that our textbook used these names. So partly what I would like to do is go over each of the stages and the weird names our textbook uses, so you have seen them. We know what they correspond to. So textbook has iCode and iFun that correspond to the parts of the first byte of the instruction, either the top 4 bits, which are the type of operation, is it a type of jump or a type of register to register move, and the last 4 bits, which tell you about condition codes for a jump or a conditional move, or tell you about the type of operation for an op queue, which could be add, subtract, XOR, and so on. And also VALC, which I'd like to note is either the jump target or the displacement or immediate for a move. Those are in different places in the instruction. Our book calls them all VALC. And we mentioned we have the decode, where we had VALA and VALB, which are our book's names for what in HTLRS were reg output A and reg output B. Yeah, well, and remember, we talked about decode, we needed RSP here, because some instructions take the stack point and don't have any other way of getting it. So let's move on to the next step. That's after decode, we had execute. So here, we perform an ALU operation. and our book has the ALU output, which they call Valley. Valley is the result of whatever the ALU operation is, no matter what operation it is. And they also have this thing they call CND, which is based on the condition codes. And CND is indicates whether the condition codes say things are taken or not. So they see it, it's updated, and basically we do this computation where we look at the condition codes and we compute based on the condition code bits of the instruction what to do. And so for example, for a CMove, we try to decide whether to write to a register or not. And our book calls this result CND. You'll be implementing this yourself, probably with a mux like what I'm showing you, where based on the condition code you choose, either always true or ORing SF and ZF or whatever the operation specified by the instruction less than, greater than, and so on requires. So any questions on this? So here's our basic setup for execute, is that we take some values, drop them in the ALU, we choose what ALU operation to do, and seems fine. So this isn't complete though. So what instructions did I not handle? So, and what you should say is, well, I just connected things to the ALU. Like, what ALU operation needs to happen for each of these instructions, and do the wires I have there let me do it? So anyone want to tell me any instruction on the list that we can't do? Yeah. Should I raise your hands preferably, but yeah. Pop. Okay, so pops. So for pop, you want to do what? You should want to subtract from, I think you mean the stack pointer? Yeah, so you want to compute pop, you want to do RSP minus 8. And, well, so to do that, with our ALU, which does add, subtract, and or XOR, we need a way of getting RSP into the ALU and either plus or positive 8 or negative 8 into the ALU. And, well, we have a way that we can get RSP into the ALU, so that's good. So this could be RSP. But we don't have a way of getting 8. So we need some way of adding 8. Of getting 8 as an input, so we need 8 as a possible input for pop. And the same thing happens for call. Call also needs to, in this case, subtract 8 from the stack. So any other of these instructions that we can't do? They're all good. We can do an up, do an add, number of Q, or any of those, we have a problem. Back there. There's no wire next to. Okay, so we don't have this yet. I agree, we're gonna need to do that. The theory is that for now, we're assuming that we can fix it as long as we don't have to like cross out a line. But I do agree, we're eventually gonna need a way to connect Valley to the register file, like for app. So that's true. I'm concerned about, I've already drawn some wires. Are any of those a problem? Like, can I not just add wires and make things work? So let's think about MR move Q. What does MR move Q do? So MR move Q, we take A. That's the instruction. What's the first thing that instruction does? Adds D and RB. Yeah. So that would be one description. So we add D and RB. Then read memory there. Memory then store. Like is a description of what the instruction does. Is that it adds D and RB, accesses memory at the result location, that's the result of that add, then stores the accessed value in the register file. That's a description of what the instruction does. And the way we do adds is generally with our ALU and our execute stage. And well, where is D on this picture? The D that I have in mRemove Q, big D, parentheses RB. Where's Val C? So it's like open for. Yeah, so this is our D. So that val C somehow needs to be connected to the ALU. And it's not. And right now, we in fact connected something else, so like we'd have two values in a wire if we did it. We need to replace that connection with a mux. Yeah.
Does that come out of the square of the
right? D parenthesis RB is the value. So this D plus RB is going to go into the memory. And out of it we'll get D plus RB will go into the memory. And the value I've written D parenthesis RB will indeed be what comes out of the memory, like you said. So those are our special cases. So we have places where we need the displacement and places where we need the constant 8 for our stack operations. And so our textbook calls the signals we compute based on this ALUA and ALUB as the actual inputs of the ALU, which for something like simple like add are just val A and val B, the register file values, but otherwise aren't. And so we add this mux here to handle that. Okay, our next stage is the memory stage. And our textbook calls the output of the memory valM. So you've seen this pattern here where our textbook has lots of things which start with val. So the hint is that the textbook has this convention where they've named 64-bit values starting with val. Is that a good idea? Probably not. It's what our textbook chose to do. That may help you figure out when reading the textbook what they mean. So generally, we saw with MR move Q, when we read from memory, we use the ALU to compute the address, and then we get that address out of the memory. When we write to the memory, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to use the ALU to compute the address, and our classic write instruction is RM move Q, so we take a register value and put it into the memory. So that gives us these sort of default connections, but again, there are some special cases where we're going to need to add something here and something here that's not in this picture to handle some instructions. So which of these instructions do we have a problem with? Someone want to tell me if knock is a problem? Do I need to do anything different for knock? So, yes. Yeah, so for NOP, we want to make sure nothing's being written. And the question is, how do we do that? How is that going to happen? Sorry?
So we can opcode, so in the instruction, and then we have a line out like a box that's going to go to the, make sure that it's set to read.
Set to read. And that's, we have these inputs here, which are mem, read, write, fit. And because we have that, NOP is not a problem, because we'll make NOP do the right thing by just setting those inputs. That's not something where we need to control the address or data though. So NOP works fine. And we can look at rmoveq. For rmoveq, we're going to set this to write. That's not a problem to do. We already say this is a function of the opcode. We're going to write, it turns out, RA into D plus RB, and there's a line I forgot to draw here. And that's going to be the address. So it's fun for rmoveq. And the same is going to be true for mrmoveq. We'll just keep ourselves from writing by not setting the right bit input, and we'll read. And we'll get a value out, which later on we can, in fact, connect to the register file like we're supposed to. So how about popq or call? Any opinions on what should happen for popq or call? Yeah?
I actually had a question about the offset. Like, how is that added again?
How is the offset added?
Yeah.
So you mean... Yeah, so you're saying we have rm move q of RA to DRB. So this line here is D. So we'll select D as the one of the ALU inputs, and then we'll have B, RB's value, as the other ALU input, and we'll add them together. And that will go into the address input. So that's the address we'll read from memory, and this will eventually go back to the register file, and hopefully we'll set up this to come right to RA. Okay. So any other questions? Okay. So how about any ideas about are we good for pop, or what needs to happen for pop or call? Either way, what needs to happen to the memory? Someone just described to me, like, you know, if you wanted me to simulate this processor by hand, and I am looking at what's happening on contents of memory, and I'm executing either pop or call, what should I be doing? Okay, so you want RSP plus 8? Okay, for which one? Okay, RP plus 8? Okay. Okay. So RSP plus 8, okay. And then what? So, okay, so we agree that one thing about pop and call is that they need to change the stack pointer. And that means they need to compute a new one. It's actually RSP minus 8, but that's same right idea. So they need to compute RSP minus 8, and we learn they're going to do that with the ALU. So that's one thing which is happening with these instructions. Now that's not what's happening with the memory, but it's useful to know. So let's remember how our stack works. So we have our stack, and RSP points to the stack. And then we have our push instruction is going to add a value below where the stack pushes and move RSP to push to point there. Or sorry, that's our push instruction, we'll do that. Okay, so RSP plus 8 for call? for push it's minus, for pop it's plus, sorry. So this is RSP minus 8, and this is what happens for push or call. So let's just look at call. So call, we're going to have RSP minus 8 be computed by the ALU. And we want to write to RSP minus 8. So the address input seems fine. How about the data input? What value do we write on the stack for call? What is that value? Call pushes a value on the stack. What value does it push? Yeah. So it's something about the PC. A bit more specific. The next address of the PC. Does that appear on this picture? The address after our current instruction. Is that on this picture anywhere yet?
Val P.
Val P. So we want to take this Val P and it needs to go into the memory. And we need to add like a mux to do that because we don't want to do that for MR move queue. Okay. So how about pop? So for pop, we have our stack and we have our value and RSP points there. And we're gonna make RSP point to RSP plus 8. This is we're actually going to add 8. But we want to read from the stack at the old location. And here we have a problem because our address input is going to be the new location. We're going to have RSP plus 8 on that line. So here we're going to have RSP plus 8. And that's not what we want. We want to read from RSP. You want to bypass the ALU for that case and use the old value, not the incremented value, because we want to read from the current RSP. Yeah?
So all of the functions require select signals, and I'm not sure I understand that word
out. All the functions require select signals, and you're asking, where do they come from? So all our select signals we've seen are if the opcode is something, do something. So there's going to be some circuit that we don't draw, which takes the opcode and has a choose selects box, and that goes to every single box. And the reason I'm not drawing it is because, boy, would this picture get really, really, really messy if I did that. But that's conceptually what we have. It's always just some function of the opcode. So far, we haven't seen any muxes which aren't. Yeah. Yeah. Question is our circuit planar, is in the sense, in the theoretical sense, like can we make draw it on a flat surface without that? And the answer is sometimes.
There are actually like really cool new transistors called FinFETs that have like a channel that's right down the middle of the transistor and it's on either side, and these circuits have multiple layers. And a lot of the ways that like as you start to shrink smaller and smaller, it gets more and more difficult to build these smaller and smaller transistors, but this FinFET approach allows you to get a lot more transistors into a particular location. You can have them not only have like one layer, but the layers on top of that. So yeah. So even though like kind of linear or flat or planar, like actual circuits are multiple.
So we have our two special cases, which I'll summarize on a much cleaner slide. So we have our address. So usually it's the ALU output, but for pop, we need the old RSP. And the same is true for RET, because RET is basically a pop, but using the value for something else. for our data. That's mostly our value to write, which is mostly val B. This is in HCLRS, reg output B, but we have some exceptions where for call and push, we want to write for call. Push, I don't think is an exception, but for call, we have our tricky case, which is that we want to write, push is also a tricky case if you think about it carefully, like which register are we reading from? You could also fix that by reading registers differently. But for call, we definitely have a tricky case. We need to write PC plus 9, which is val P. For push, we need to write register A's value, which probably isn't val B, but we could have made it val B if we added a box earlier. So we got our refinement here. I've not drawn the val P all the way around just to make this diagram less cluttered. So then we have our write register stage. So we just need to supply a value to our two write inputs and the register number inputs. So here I've done that in the most straightforward way. I've said that, well, when we write a value from memory, we're writing it from RA, we write a value from a computation, we write it to RB, so I connected those register numbers, and we also need to choose what value we write, so the value from memory goes into the M slot, the value from the ALU goes into the E slot. So again, there are cases where I need some muxes in the circle, so can anyone tell me any one of these instructions where one of those circles I drew needs a mux? Of this list. Yeah?
Destination
E
needs
one. Okay. For which in one are you thinking?
For destination E.
For which instruction is this mux important? For NOP. So for NOP, we need some way of putting in 15 for destination E. And it turns out we also need this for some other instructions, like we need this for MRMoveQ, which needs to write a value from memory, but shouldn't write the value it's computing in the ALU, which is what this would do if we don't prevent that from happening. So any other places we need a mux or inputs we need to the mux I already drew? So what way I go about this is say, we're executing push. What's going to be on the wires that I've circled? That's what you should think. I'm running push. What should I have on that? The wires I'm circled. So you're saying, okay, so which one, so you're saying for push, I need to specify RSP, is your complaint. So where do I need to specify RSP? Destination M, you say. Okay. So you want to put RSP here. So that means that we're going to take write to RSP from destination M, which if we trace it back, comes from the data memory. Okay. So the ALU one. So probably we'll add another input to desti. We could have used destination M, but then we need to add a mux on in another circle to make that work, which would be a fine choice. Also, you could have also just said, we're going to also make it so the next destination M value input can come from the ALU. That would be fine. That's not what I drew. Okay, so now we can write to RSP, which we need to do for push. Turns out we also need to do that for pop and call. So they both compute a new value in RSP with the ALU, and so they'll all take advantage of that. Is there anything else we're missing in those circles? Any muxes I need to add now? Still. Yeah. We shouldn't be writing anything to destination M for not. Yes, so we do need a mux here to supply 15, definitely. We don't have a choice. Yeah.
For push and pop, it should only write to one register. So we have to have, I think, for on the next R of M or R of Desi, one of them has to like specify not to be written to.
So you say for push and pop, it should only write to one. So we have the option for each of these. We've added the OXF input, 15, so we can avoid writing. However, you said, so push only needs to write to one. So push RA writes to RA, writes to what register? It writes to RSP. Okay, how about pop RA? Writes to RA, anything else? An RSP, okay. This is an important thing that people often forget, is that pop writes to two registers. If you're wondering, why does our register file have two write register numbers? This is why, because otherwise we can't do pop. And is in fact the only reason. Like, if we didn't have the pop instruction, you would probably have a register file which could only write one register at a time. Okay, and I think that's everything. So we have our two destination register numbers we need to compute. And we need to deal with register zero. So one thing I'd note, and I mentioned this last time, is that there's the issue of how we deal with RR move Q and IR move Q. Move Q. And what I would think would be the most straightforward way is we just say, okay, sometimes instead of taking the ALU value, we take the value of a register directly or the value of the immediate directly. And our textbook's decision is that instead we take the value of a register or the immediate and add zero. Or subtract zero. Or XOR with zero. Either works. You can do either, whatever you feel more comfortable with. Okay, so we finally have our last stage, which is updating the PC. So usually, it's the val p we already computed, the next instruction address. But we have three exceptions. We have call and conditional jumps, and unconditional jumps, where it's sometimes val c, which is the constant from the instruction. And we have return. Where do we get the return address for return? Where in our processor is it going to be? Someone, yeah. It's on the stack. So from the stack. So in this picture here, where will I find that value?
Data out.
Data out. So it's going to come from here. Yes, so we need to put it in the PC in addition to val c. So we'll end up with something like this. So now that we've gone through that, do exercise for, you know, how do we set all these muxes we know about for pop, which I don't think we did last time, right? Yeah. Tell me how any one of these is set. Yeah. Yes, so the PC mux is our val P. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you're saying destination M, which is what memory gets written to, needs to come from RA. Okay. Destination E should be RSP because we also need to update the stack pointer as we just mentioned. Okay. Any other signals we should set? Any other muxes we have a choice for? Yeah.
We have to set the
mux. We have to use 8 because we're going to end up adding 8. Okay. There's a few more we have to set. Yeah. Yeah, so ALUB shouldn't be 0. We don't want to compute 0 plus 8. We want to compute RSP plus 8. There's 3 more muxes I haven't drawn lines with. So, yeah. Source B should be RSP. If we want to compute RSP plus 8, we need to read RSP. And we don't want to read, we want to read from RSP, not RSP plus 8. And we have one more mux left over, which is the one that decides data input. This doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because this is going to be not writing. And that's not clear. Should be a 0. So it doesn't matter what data input we put. Okay. So any questions on our single cycle processor here? Okay, so let's go on to our next topic. We're going to talk about making circuits faster and but we're going to start with a more manual example. Talk about doing laundry. So I have some laundry to do, and I have enough that I have 2 loads. So I take my whites, I put them in the washer, then after a while they're done, I lug them from the washer into the dryer, wait a while, they're finally dry, I take them out of the dryer, I fold them, then put them away. Finally, I'm done with the first load, then I can move on to the second load. I take my colors, put them in the washer, wait for them to finish, take them out, put them in the dryer, wait for that, then take them out, fold them, put them away. So anyone see any problem with this approach? Seem anyone have any suggestions for why I shouldn't do this? Yeah. Yeah, I have all this time when the washer isn't doing anything. Why am I wasting the washer? You know, I could just use the washer right away and I get my laundry done much faster and in the same amount of time, in less time, I could do more laundry even. And this is the idea of pipelining, that we have multiple steps and we want to, you know, do one step, pass on each load to the next, and start that same first step or with the next loop. You just want to do this sort of a, what you might think of as assembly line operation, do multiple things together, and not just leave some component of eventually our processor idle while we're waiting for the instruction to complete. Instead, we're going to go on to the next thing to do. This is the idea of pipelining. Now, we're going to make things more efficient by writing multiple things together and just do one step, then move on to the next. When we move on to the next step, we do that same step for the next thing. So, and the idea is that this is a lot more efficient. And apparently, I don't have a mic anymore. A lot more efficient than if we did the other thing, because intuitively, many of you realize that you would never do laundry this way. You would not wait, you know, watch the washer just be nice and empty, and you have more laundry to do. You would not let that happen. You would start using that washer. So one thing to observe is that we have, you know, imperfection here. That we would, you know, guess that we're, you know, after we do this, we should, you know, be fully using the washer. And we're not. We have this wasted time that we could be using the washer for more if only we had a way to. But there's a little extra time during which the washer is unused. And realistically, it would be kind of weird for a dryer. You know, it's a very fast dryer if it's about as fast as the washer. So probably it's more likely that it's more like this, that I have a bunch of time when, because my washer can't keep up with my dryer, I have stuff in my washer that I can't move to the dryer yet. So our speed is determined by this dryer part, this slowest piece. And when determining how much this strategy of pipelining helps us, we're going to want to look at how long does it take to do each, you know, do these bunches of loads of laundry. And we're going to look at two quantities. So one is, I have a specific load of laundry. How long did I take to do that? How long from when I started it to when I finished it did it take? And this is known as latency. So latency is the time it takes to do one thing. So we'll just look at one load, and in this case I'm looking at it after we've started. And I'm going to say the time from when I start to when I finish, that's my latency. So here it's 2.1 hours. And it includes this bunch of time where we're just sitting there leaving this load of laundry, not doing anything useful because we were waiting for the dryer to be free. And note that this means that if this is what you were measuring, if you're saying how long does it take you to do each load of laundry, that pipelining is slower. It takes me longer. Each one takes me like an extra 20 minutes. And if what I was concerned about is you hand me a load of laundry, how long until I hand it back to you all clean, it's worse. But of course it's worth it because this isn't the quantity we care about. We don't really care how long each load takes. We have a whole bunch of laundry that piled up. We want to get it all done. We care about the rate of getting lots of stuff done, not just this one thing that's part of our overall task. And the same is going to be even more true for, like, our processor. For our processor, we have like a function with 50 instructions. What I care about is how long does it take to run 50 instructions, not how long does each instruction take. And so what we care about is what's known as throughput, the rate at which we complete many things, the rate at which things, you might say, finish. So once we get started, how often can I finish a load of laundry? If I have a whole bunch to do, what's the interval between when I finish them. And notice that this is the same as the interval between when I start them, and that's just because it's determined by how fast the dryer is. And therefore, it's also the same as the interval between when I start using the dryer for different loads or when I finish using the washer for different loads once I get started. It's all the same time, and this is all measuring our throughput. So we have our time between finishes, which if we take our throughput in units of work done per unit time, we get that we have 1.2 loads an hour, and that's typically the sort of units we'll give throughput in. So like for a processor, instructions per some second or something like that. And this is really what we care about, you know, when we're saying, obviously I should use the washer right away, is that we want to make this throughput number higher, and we don't really care that the latency for each load is going to be a bit worse, because that's not what we're trying to fix. And with our processor, we're going to do things which are going to make our latency number for instructions higher, but we don't care, because when you say a processor's fast, you mean it runs your entire program with many millions of instructions to execute fast. You don't mean that it runs each load fast. That's not the part you care about. So any questions about either throughput or latency, how you would compute it, what the relationship is? I guess one thing I should note is I'm looking at throughput here in the steady state. This is generally what we will do. We're going to ignore, you know, something which happened here where when things were getting started up, they were a little weird, a little different. We'll just assume that we're in this place where we're doing lots of stuff and, you know, we have to wait in line all the time if there's something slow. Okay, so this is pipelining for laundry. Obviously, that's not what we're actually doing in this class. We're doing circuits. So let's start with pipelining a circuit. So I have a toy circuit here. This is a circuit which multiplies a number by 3 in a rather stupid way by using two adders. So first, we add the input A to itself to compute 2 times A. Then we add 2 times A and A to compute 3 times A. And let's say that the adder, we have to put in a value, and once the value gets here, we need to get it all the way through to the end, combined with the other value. And this, let's say this takes 50 nanoseconds. So once we have an input on the adder, it takes 50 nanoseconds for the output to definitely be the answer, not to be changing, because you know the circuit is a physical thing that takes some time to do a computation. And that same is going to be true of the other. Then we can think of this timeline, 50 to be consistent here, picoseconds. So really small unit of time. So we say we put in A is 7 on this blue wire, then this adder starts computing, and after 50 picoseconds, finally it has the answer, and on the green line, it has 14. 7 plus 7. So at that point, finally the second adder has both of its inputs stable, so it can start doing useful computation. And after 50 picoseconds, it too finishes its computation. It computes 14 plus 7 and gets 21 and outputs the answer. So after 100 picoseconds, we get 3 times A. And so that's our latency. And because we're doing one thing at a time, that's also going to be our throughput. If we have a whole bunch of numbers to multiply times 3, we're going to do them one after the other with this design, that we're going to get 10 results per nanosecond. which is exactly the reciprocal of our latency because we're doing one at a time. And we have the same observation we had with our washer, and that our first adder, well, over here, it's not really doing anything. Like, we aren't doing any useful work there. And similarly, our second adder over here, it wasn't really doing anything, and we'd really like to use that time. And if we have more things to multiply times 3, well, we should start doing the first step, the a plus a step of that next multiplication times 3 right away in this first blank space here. So what we want to get is instead of a timeline like this, where we put in 7, 14 gets computed, and we get out that, we want to move this over. So we can put in 17 right here and get our result out of 51 early. So you get a timeline something like this, where we put in 7, then we get out the 14, and we somehow add 14 and 7 while we're adding 17 plus 17, the first step. And we can keep putting in numbers, and we get all our multiplications times 3 done in a lot less time than we would with the non-pipelined version. So something to note about this is that I said that our first adder wasn't really doing anything in this point in time. That's not entirely true. It was doing one important piece of work, and that's holding the value 14. That because this adder was here, that's why this wire 2 times a actually had the value 14. That wasn't changing. When we switch to inputting different values, the value 14 is not going to be the output of the adder anymore. It's going to be changing as it's computing the new number. So we need some way to make sure the value 14 is still on the wire, and that way is going to be with a register. We're going to use a register to hold the value since our adder is no longer doing it. We also have our value 7 here that we need to add to 14, and that value needs to be held somewhere, and we can't just have it be the main input because we just wanted to change that to 17. So we're going to also need a register for that. So we end up with a circuit like this, where one way of thinking about what we did is I just drew a line across the middle of the circuit and split it in half, and everything that line crossed, I added the register. And the idea is we want to store the values the second half of the circuit is using, while the first half of the circuit is computing different values. And the registers are exactly what does that. I also added registers at each end, so we have a place where we know the value is coming from and going to, just to make things consistent for each stage. So with this circuit, we have our desired timeline. I guess I should talk about, I have this t plus 2, t plus 1. These are the times at which each value corresponds to, because we have a's for each different time. And this is saying that the a for times at time 0, a value 0 is here. We have 3 times a. And at time 0, a value 1 is here, and so on. So here we input 7 after the next rising edge of the clock. We have 7 on the next register and 14. And meanwhile, 17 is being input as the next number. And then on the following rising edge of the clock, we've computed 7 plus 14 is 21, and now that's being output over here. And meanwhile, we've determined that 17, we have 17 plus 17 is 34, and that 34 gets copied over to here, and that's so on. Guess I probably, since people look confused, should go through, I'll go through what happens on our first rising edge. First. So at our first rising edge, we have, beforehand, we had 7 being output from this register, which means 7 is being input to this register. And 7 is input to both sides of this adder. So our adder is going to say 7 plus 7, okay, that's 14. So 14 is being input to this register. And our rising edge of the clock happens, and what every register does on the rising edge of the clock is read its input and copy it to its output. So when the rising edge of the clock happens, we take this 7 here, copy it. We take this 14 here, copy it. And we also take whatever our input was, which happens to have been 17, and copy it. Yes? Why do I count backwards? And why is t plus 0 then t plus 1? So this is going to have our first value, our second value, and our third value, because the last value we put in is leftmost. So the first value which comes out is going to come out to the from the right side first. And that's why it's plus 0. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So this is an assembly line. Things move from left to right. So the things that are rightmost are oldest. Because they've been in the system the longest. Sorry, things that are on the right are the, I need to remember. Yes, on the right are the oldest. I need to remember which way you're looking. Because they've been in the system, because they've come from the left, so they've been there the longest. So the 7 was there at the start, so we're saying the 7 is here at the start, and at the end, and in the next stage, it ends up here. And 17 is there, that's what I'm trying to draw. So your confusion is the 7 was there at the start? Yes. And this picture at the start, we don't know the value of everything that's further right. At the very start. Yeah?
Could you just go over again what happens at the rising edge of the clock?
So at the rising edge, at this first rising edge of the clock, 17 is being input here. So that's going to be copied, replacing 7, which was previously being output. At the same time, 14, the result of 7 plus 7, is being input to the green register. And will be output after that rising edge instead of the unknown value that was there before. And at the same time, 7, which was previously the output of this first blue register, is being input to the second blue register and will start being output after that rising edge instead of the unknown value that was there before. Is that clear?
Before this, at some point, a 7 was loaded onto the first register?
Yes, so sometime over here, the input to that register was 7. And I'm just not, don't have infinite number of lines, so I didn't draw all the signals. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about how fast this is. So we learned with our laundry example that we sped things up a lot, and it looked like we should nearly, double the speed. That was our idea. But if you look at this timeline I drew, I'm telling you that somehow doing two things takes a little more than 100 picoseconds, even though each add was 50. So why did I add some extra time there? And there's an issue that we have to add these registers. And registers are physical things that need to actually do stuff. And then the universe is not physically instantaneous. So we have our register. Remember how our register works is it takes its input, copies it to its output at the rising edge of the clock, which we've basically imagined is kind of instantaneous, but it's not. In particular, registers have these tolerances to make sure that they work correctly. There's some time before the rising edge of the clock during which the input needs to not change. If the input changes, the register might not know what value to copy to the output. So there needs to be some time during which that input is stable, other than just instantly at the rising edge of the clock. And after the rising edge of the clock, the register might take some time to physically change its output values because you can't change from 0 to 3 volts instantaneously. So there's some time during which the output is changing. And both of these mean that we can't just take our 50 picoseconds of adding and do it every 50 picoseconds. We need to wait for the registers to store the previous store the next values and load the previous value. Load the next values and store the previous values, or whatever combination you want. And the combination of this time we're going to call the register delay. We're not, in this class, going to be concerned about the difference between the time during which the input can't change and the time during which the output is changing. We're just going to call the whole thing the register delay. And we're going to say that this is extra time we need to wait because we can't have the add doing work during this time. It needs to have the same output this entire time. Or for the time where the output's changing, it can't rely on its input to be stable during this time. This is extra time we need to wait. And that means when we look at our circuit here, we have 10 picoseconds for each of these registers, because we need to wait 10 picoseconds to do them, and the time for each stage in this pipeline circuit is 60 picoseconds, which means our throughput is going to be 1 over 60 picoseconds, or 16 billion operations a second. Question is the register delay dependent on your circuit? As far as we're concerned, it's going to be a property of the register that whoever designs the register is going to tell us.
So the transistors in the register have capacitance in them, so they're charging up, it's stabilizing. So there's called setup and delay time. So there's this setup time that's associated with these registers. I think that the circuits are kind of charging up and stabilizing at a particular point for the transistors that are associated with whatever makeup is for the register. And as Charles said, depending on your register design, you'll have different setup times for the register.
Yeah. But it's a physical property depending on how the register is built. And we're not going to deal with how you build registers in this class. So we're just going to assume someone tells us, and they're probably even telling us a value which is a little higher than it needs to be because they want to be sure our processor works correctly. So there we have 16 billion operations a second, where when we started out, we were at, originally we were 1 over 100 picoseconds, which was about 20. This is without pipelining. So by adding pipelining, by splitting the circuit in half, we made it less than twice as fast. And that's because we had to pay for this register delay. That previously wasn't so much of a concern. Okay. So, yeah. Or sorry, 10. That should be 10. Let's write, also write numbers clearly. 1, 0, 10. Yes. 1 over 100 picoseconds does not give us a 2 anywhere. So almost twice, not quite twice as fast. Significantly less than twice as fast. But, you know, we made it faster. So that seems good. So one question is, could we do this again? You know, we divided the circuit in half. Why don't we divide it in half again? Just, you know, we just drew a line and added registers. Let's just do that again. Draw two more lines, add registers across them. You know, the adder must do something and have some intermediate values. We'll just store those. There we go. You know, and let's say we somehow succeed at doing this, and now we have, you split up that 50 picoseconds in half again, so we have 25 picoseconds. So let's say we did this. What's our throughput? You know, I split up each adder in half from 50 picoseconds to 225 picosecond chunks with a register in between. What's our throughput now? Sorry? What? 1 over, you went 1 over 70? 7? And where do you get 70?
60.
Okay, so you're saying we have 60 for this part and an additional 10? Okay, so this is assuming that our stage is still that this whole thing is one stage. But what we could do if we have registers like this is we could say instead that this is the first stage, this is the second stage, this is the third stage, and this is the fourth stage. So it's better than that. 1/35, as you say. So this is our first stage, second stage, they're all the same. So it's 1/35 picoseconds, which turns out to be around 28 billion seconds. So we divide it into four pieces, and it's a little less than 3 times as fast. Okay, so that's great. We can just keep doing this, and everything, you know, will make our processor really fast. Really, really fast. It solves all our speed problems. So there are some questions you might have. So one issue is, well, let's say we could do that. How much faster can we get? That's the first question we'll look at. There's another question, which is, can we do this? Like, is it actually possible to just split the adder in half like this? Or do we have to do something that's not quite as good? The answer is, we are going to have to do something that's not quite as good. That, you know, can't just draw a line anywhere in a circuit and split it into pieces. That's not how the world works, so we're gonna have to do something not as good as that. Let's start with how much faster we can get. Can we just, you know, if assuming we can just divide up the adder, that someone who designs adders is doing a really good job at making the logic into some smaller and smaller pieces for us. Can we just make, you know, assuming that's possible, make our processor as fast as we like? And the way to think about this is, well, originally, we had all our logic and a register to put it in. When we split it up in half, we had our logic and a register, so we need 60 picoseconds for each stage. We split it up into three, we have 33, then a register, so 43. And eventually, we're doing a little bit of work and then the register stuff. So we're doing like a picosecond or less than a picosecond of work, and then waiting for a register, which we're saying, you know, our registers designer tells us it takes 10 picoseconds. And if we plot this, this is a plot of time per completion, so the time per stage, or the inverse of throughput. And you can see that we have this asymptote, that we're never going to get better than the register delay. We're going to get closer and closer the more pieces we can divide things into. It never gets better. And most of our benefit came from adding the second stage. Second stage gave us, in this case, 1.8x speed up. Adding the 15th stage gave us 2% extra. And we can look at the same thing in terms of throughput, in which case we again have an asymptote. We're getting closer and closer to the maximum rate of register updates. What if we only care about the register delay? That's our entire stage, is just the register delay. And so this is the limitation we have, is that the register delay ultimately limits how effective our pipelining could be, even when, if we can just say we chop up the adder in half and split up its work exactly. And it's going to turn out that, well, we can't do that. That we can't do that. We cannot actually split up the adder in half. We're going to have to make some compromise. We're going to do something that's less good as we want to add more and more pipeline stages to our circuit to try to make it faster and faster. And we're going to have an additional reason that it's going to end up being a lot slower than, you know, sort of our ideal would be that you divide the circuit into four pieces, it's four times as fast. So we have two reasons why that's not going to happen. And one is that we have this register delay. The other is that we're not actually going to be able to divide it up evenly into four pieces. And we're going to talk more about that after the exam. So this is where I'll finish up today to kind of take it sync, stay in sync. And also because this is like where what will be on the exam ends. Next lecture, we will do exam review. Please come with questions you would like answered. If you don't ask questions about something, we assume you know it and don't need it reviewed.